10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0. Ignition and liftoff.
Welcome to episode 8 of the Mitchell Institute's Aerospace Advantage podcast.
I'm your host, John Slickbaum, and today we're going to focus on our nation's military activities in space. Now, as a combat pilot and weapons school instructor, I value the capability that Space Guardians bring to the fight like none other. Satellites and other space technologies may seem abstract because we really don't see them very often, but the reality is that each of us are surrounded by an invisible web of space-based capabilities at nearly every turn of our daily lives. To better understand this topic, we are talking with United States Space Force Chief of Space Operations, General Jay Raymond, on today's episode. We also have Mitchell Dean, Lieutenant General David Deptula, with us as well. So with that, let's dig in. General Deptula, before we bring in General Raymond, I think it's important to set the stage with some context. And this starts by recognizing that space capabilities are intertwined in every aspect of our daily lives. When you wake up and check your smartphone, you've just accessed a space-based network. The weather data you view when you prepare for the day was largely gathered through satellites. If you stop at the ATM or purchase fuel at the gas station on your way to work, all of these systems are fundamentally reliant on timing systems provided by the Space Force's GPS constellation. The same satellites will direct you to a meeting you have later on that day if you use your car's GPS or the GPS on your phone. And more importantly, when you get ready for bed, you are not worried about a major national security issue like a nuclear attack or surprise invasion because you know that the U.S. Department of Defense is using space-based systems 24/7 to watch nearly every sector of the globe. In fact, U.S. space systems are so good that even mentioning something like a surprise military attack now sounds implausible or completely odd. Now, that wasn't always the case. Just think about the disaster at Pearl Harbor.
Well, Slick, I think you're right. The same reliance exists in a military context. As a fighter pilot, the weather data I used to require to plan my flights was gathered by satellites. As a combined joint task force commander for the no-fly zones in northern Iraq, when I was leading combat missions, space-based imagery and space-based sensors would give me the critical situation awareness on threats that I'd need to avoid getting shot down. And targeting information that we used every day was also generated in collaboration with space-based systems. And when you think about it, during the opening phases of our response to the Al-Qaeda attacks on 9/11, when I was a commander of the Combined Air Operations Center for Operation Enduring Freedom, one night we were faced with a serious situation where one of our special ops helicopters was down. My first reaction was to call on our space-based capabilities to provide an immediate response. That was 20 years ago. Even then, space had become an integral element of our warfighting capabilities, not just providing support. Now, we need to protect our asymmetric advantages in space, and that requires a space force that's set up for success.
Sir, that's the crux of today's show. America's adversaries have studied our dependence on space, and they believe it's an Achilles heel. Make no mistake, that is why China launched an anti-satellite weapon and destroyed one of its own satellites in 2007. It was sending a clear, assertive, and highly threatening signal to the United States and our allies that it has the ability and willingness to weaponize space.
Exactly. We also need to recognize that space is an ecosystem. Blowing up a satellite fills up that orbital track with countless pieces of debris. And orbital speeds are very fast. The International Space Station orbits at over 17,000 miles per hour. So a piece of a destroyed satellite impacting with a neighboring functioning satellite risks great damage and even possible destruction. Space debris is actually one of the reasons why the United States and the Soviet Union avoided, and they worked hard at avoiding weaponizing space during the Cold War. That same consensus isn't held by our adversaries today because both China and Russia are actively weaponizing space.
Sir, as you know, weaponizing space isn't just about shooting down satellites. Our opponents have also designed and tested space systems that get close to our satellites to spy on them or even disable them. They've blinded our satellites with lasers and developed technologies to strike ground-based space control systems.
Their offensive cyber technologies are focused on disrupting the data flows to and from our space-based systems.
Well, Slick, the takeaway here is simple. America and her allies need peaceful, dependable access to space. Our peer adversaries are working very hard to weaponize this domain. This demands a prudent strategy and corresponding set of investments to ensure that our space enterprise is sufficiently resilient to operate under attack.
Well, sir, what is your take on the space enterprise today? Because, you know, many people hear about the new Space Force and Space Command. So what's the difference?
Well, Slick, this involves some basic military organization. There are two major organizational elements of our military. First, the services, which generally everybody is familiar with, the Air Force, Space Force, Navy, Army, and Marine Corps. And second, less well known, are the combatant commands. Now, the services organize, train, and equip forces. The combatant commands, however, are the actual organizations who do the warfighting. They request specific capabilities from the services to man and equip joint task forces who actually do the fighting. And just to add some extra clarity here, the combatant commands are responsible either for geographic regions or specific functions like transportation. An example would be Indo-Pacific Command, who's in charge of all military operations in Asia, while Transportation Command looks after all modes of logistics and mobility. So we now have a separate service for space, the U.S. Space Force, which is within the Department of the Air Force, much like how the Marine Corps is part of the Department of the Navy. And we also have a combatant command for space in the form of the U.S. Space Command.
Well, sir, with that said, now that we have these two new space-focused components on the military, has that solved our space problems? Or, you know, what types of issues do the space organizations face?
Well, forming a new service and a new combatant command were major muscle moves, but there's still a lot of work to be done to set them up for long-term success. A July 2016 Government Accountability Office report noted that there were some 60 stakeholder organizations all having a role in national security space. The GAO's conclusion, too many cooks are spoiling the broth. The vice president echoed that sentiment in March of 2019, saying that spreading the national security space program so thinly has resulted in a glaring lack of leadership and accountability that undermines our combat commanders and it puts our warfighters at risk. So if the nation is serious about dealing with the threats facing us in space, those 60 government organizations need to be integrated into the Space Force with the associated transfer of resources as well. You know, if folks don't know by now, to be clear, money is everything. It's what buys capabilities, builds competent teams, and fuels innovation. Now, the Space Force is in a really tough spot here. Congress created the new service, but it did not rebalance resourcing within the Department of Defense. There's a reason why the United States Air Force is the smallest and the oldest it's ever been in its history, and why the Space Force today finds itself stretched so thin. Because combined, they both receive less than 20% of the defense budget. So if DOD is serious about space, it needs to rebalance how the money flows. And this isn't going to be solved by gutting the Air Force. All the services need to contribute, for they're all equally reliant on space-based systems. It's also a major reason why the bureaucratic streamlining that I mentioned about putting all those 60 other elements under the Space Force is critical. We put a lot on their shoulders, and they need to be set up for success. In summary, what I'd like to get across is that that means the Space Force needs to be, one, fully funded, two, fully manned, and three, assigned at least some of those 60 stakeholder organizations with a role in national security space to consolidate our defense space functions into the U.S. Space Force.
Well, sir, thank you for that rundown. And without further delay, we've got a very special guest with us today, our nation's first Chief of Space Operations, General Jay Raymond. Sir, thank you and welcome to the show.
No, Slick, I can't thank you enough, and I can't thank you and General Deptula enough for the opportunity to spend some time with you. You know, I was reflecting on what I might say today in this podcast, and you know, I thought about the 30-year anniversary of Desert Storm, and it's important for today for two reasons. One, we've got the lead planner here for Desert Storm, General Deptula, and two, Desert Storm has long been referred to as the first space war by some. Yeah, I actually don't think it's the first space war. I actually think the Cold War was the first space war. But I do clearly understand the significance of Desert Storm to space. It's the first time that we integrated strategic space capabilities into the theater for operational advantage. And that was all done by General Deptula and his team forward in theater. And since that time, my entire career after Desert Storm until today, until a few years ago, was all focused on integrating space into the fight. And I just want to take my hat off to General Deptula for the groundbreaking work he did on that, and for really getting us started to where we are today of integrating space for national advantage.
Well, hey, General Raymond, it's General Deptula here. I really appreciate your time today, and thank you very much for the kind words. I think your assessment is spot on. The Cold War was the first real space war. A matter of fact, the Cold War is pretty much defined by the early space launches. And the first thing that our nation started thinking of in the context of space was perspective. And that's viewing from above, getting information that we couldn't get from any other way. And you're exactly spot on in terms of integration with the rest of our military forces. And boy, has it really changed from the Cold War and Desert Storm to today. So let's jump right into the issues. When did you fundamentally see a change most recently in how our competitors were approaching the space domain? And what I'm talking about here is transitioning from peaceful uses to actors interested in weaponizing space. What are their motivations and intent?
Yeah, so first of all, let me ask, when did I first realize it? I can give you the date. It was 11 January 2007. I was deployed in the CENTCOM AOR as the Director of Space Forces, a position that really grew out of kind of the Desert Storm experience of needing to integrate space into theater. And we put senior space officers in theater working for the CFAC to make sure the CFAC has everything that they need to be able to do their mission. And in fact, in most cases, the CFAC acts as what we call the Space Coordinating Authority. And the Director of Space Forces, what we call the DIR Space Force, executes that Space Coordinating Authority on behalf of the CFAC. But on 11 January 2007, I remember we had just gotten finished with the morning master air attack plan briefing, and word came that China blew up one of their own satellites and blew it into, at the time we didn't know, but today we know, over 3,000 pieces of debris, and that we're largely still tracking today. And it was really striking to me, because here I am in a position to integrate space into everything that we do in the AOR, but yet there is now this very visible, tangible event that showed that access to space is no longer a given. And that, to me, changed my thinking. When I came back, one of the things that everybody always asked me was, what's the one thing the warfighter needed from space? And that's not what I came home with. What I came home with was, everything that we do is enabled by space. There's not just one thing, it's everything. The other thing that I came home with is that access to space is no longer a given. So I look back on 1991 and the Desert Storm time when this thing first started. We've made great strides in this, great strides in the integration of space. And again, there's nothing that we do that is done without that integration. What is different, though, a few things. One, space is no longer a peaceful domain without a threat. The second thing is, if deterrence were to fail, the adversaries that we would be up against, or competitors, or however you want to describe them, are going to have those same space capabilities that we enjoy today. That wasn't the case in Desert Storm, or in largely what we're doing today in the CENTCOM AOR. And the last thing that I would suggest to you is, as you know better than I know, coming out of Desert Storm, we were coming out of the Cold War, and we had a bunch of force structure, and we were using that force structure that was built for the Cold War to do that fight. That's not the case today. Our joint warfighting constructs and our force structure are all built around assured access to space. And I will tell you today, that's not a given.
Sir, in 2014, then commander of U.S. Air Force Space Command and now vice chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General John Hyten, went on 60 Minutes and revealed threat information that was previously classified. Now, this was a big deal. Can you please talk about how important it was to sound this public alarm?
Yeah, so Slick, you know, I also participated in that 60 Minutes interview. And one of the things that really what we did was began having the public conversation about space as a warfighting domain. In the past, we didn't talk about that. We didn't want, and today we don't want space to become a warfighting domain. Our main mission is to deter that from happening. But we began to have that conversation. I think it's important for two reasons. First of all, I think every American needs to understand just how reliant their life is on space. And it's hard to understand that when you have satellites that are orbiting, you know, 22,000 nautical miles above your head and moving at speeds, you know, in low Earth orbit of 17,500 miles an hour. It's hard to have that connection. But trust me, there is a very strong connection. Americans' way of life is fueled by space capabilities. Just as our way of war has been fueled by space capabilities, largely since Desert Storm, as we've grown that over the course of the last three decades. The other thing that I think it's important for Americans to understand is that, again, access to space is not a given. There is a threat there, and that we have to be able to prepare. We have to be prepared to handle that threat. So this past year, I talked very publicly about a Russian satellite that moved in close proximity to one of our satellites that demonstrated behavior of a weapon system. What we now know is that is a weapon system that was purposely designed to kill, kinetically destroy U.S. satellites in low Earth orbit. You know, China also has a satellite called the Xizhan 17. It's a Chinese satellite that has a robotic arm that's in orbit today. It's space-based technology that in the future could be used to grapple a satellite. China has multiple ground-based laser systems of varying power levels that could be used to blind or damage satellite systems. Russia also has several ground-based lasers that could jam and blind satellite sensors. You know, we just talked about the very public event of 2007 where China demonstrated the ability to blow up a satellite with a missile from the ground. Russia has the same thing called Anudal, and it's the Russian mobile ground-based variant of that of the Chinese capability. And so, as you can see, the domain is very contested. We can't take that for granted. That's why it was so important in 2019 for both the U.S. Space Command to get reestablished and for the Space Force to be established, to stay ahead of that growing threat, to make sure that space capabilities that we are so reliant on, both as a nation and as a military, are always there. And it's important to note that it's bigger than just about space. Space underpins every instrument of national power, diplomatic, information, military, economic. Look at the, you know, the trillion-dollar economy that's being projected in space. Space underpins all of that, and it's important that it's always there.
Now, Strategic Command, to those of us who are old enough to remember when it was in existence, used to have a famous phrase during the Cold War, peace through strength. In many ways, I could see that applying to the Space Force today. Given that we never actually want to see conflict extend to space, how do you deter adversaries from pursuing hostile actions in space? And how is space deterrence different than what we see here on Earth?
Yeah, so I get asked that question a lot. And I started my career in Strategic Air Command, so I am old enough to know that. And I served as the STRATCOM strategic planner, the J5, a few years ago. And I wouldn't say I'm a deterrence expert by any means, but I've been in that business for a while. And what I would say is, first of all, I would say there's no such thing as a space war. It's just war. And war that is a nation could choose to fight that war on the ground, in the air, on the sea, or in space. And so it's a domain of warfare. And again, we do not want to get into a conflict that begins or extends into space. We want to deter it. The second thing is, I don't think there's anything such thing called space deterrence. I think it's just deterrence. And I think space can amplify the deterrence messages of multiple domains to change the calculus of a competitor and adversary from doing us harm. And it's the old deterrence calculus of imposing costs and denying benefits. We can play in that in space. And in fact, it's not just about deterring activity in space. Our view is that if you deter conflict in space, you will then have the opportunity to deter conflict from spilling over into other domains. So Dave, historically, as you refer back to SAC, you think of the triad as the strategic deterrence piece for America. I would suggest it's much broader today, and space and cyber would be included in that calculus as well.
Thanks for that.
General Raymond, let's talk about the opportunities. What goals do you have from a capability perspective, and what new functions would you like your successors to have 5 or 10 years from now?
Yeah, so first of all, I would say before discussing capabilities, what I would really like my successors to have are some norms of behavior, some rules of the road for how to operate in space. We're working really hard on that. Today, it's kind of the wild, wild west, and we have got to, working with our partners and our allies, which we're doing, develop some norms of behavior on what's safe and professional. We've made some really good progress on that with our closest partners and excited for where that's going to go. But we've got a lot more work to do on that. And that would be one thing that I think my successors need to have. Then if I look back, both in my former warfighting hat when I was the U.S. Space Command commander, and now today in my Space Force chief hat where I provide capabilities to that warfighter, I think the U.S. Space Command commander needs to have the ability to command and control their forces. And I think the U.S. Space Command commander needs to have the ability to have domain awareness. I think those are two must-haves. In any warfighting domain, a commander that's responsible for operations in that domain has to be able to have the awareness of the domain in which they operate in. And that's not easy with space. Space is vast. I mean, if you look at the AOR of U.S. Space Command, it's 100 kilometers above the Earth's surface and higher globally. That is huge. Any other AOR pales in comparison to size. And if you look at the speed of which things are happening in space, and if you look at the increased activity that's happening in space, I think, SpaceX just had a world record a couple days ago on the numbers of satellites that were launched off of one rocket. I think it was 149 satellites off of one rocket. And so if you think about all that, that domain awareness challenge is a real world challenge. So command and control, domain awareness. The other thing you have to be able to do is you have to be able to defend what you have in orbit. So those capabilities I would like my successor to have. And then if you look at the United States Space Command UCP mission, it says the United States Space Command commander shall conduct offensive and defensive operations. We also have to be able to give a punch. And so domain awareness, command and control, defense and offense, as any military armed service would have, are things that I would like my successors to have capability wise. And I would like to have norms of behavior that will help guide safe and professional behavior in that domain.
Well, General Raymond, could you speak a bit about some of the major technological trends that you're observing in space? You just mentioned one. I mean, that's pretty incredible. One rocket launching over 140 satellites at one time. Really, really impressive. So from a cursory perspective, there are lots of things in play, ranging from the advent of small satellites. Obviously, that's what this launch involved, to an increasing range of different launch options. So what do you think?
Yeah, so I guess I would first start with an answer that might not be technology focused, and that's just the business model focus. If you look at the speed of which commercial industry is moving, it's really, really fast. They are doing in months what is taking us the same number of years. That has to change. We have to go faster. And that assembly line approach changes the whole calculus on what we're doing in space. Today our satellites are very large, very expensive. They're nationally critical. They take a long time to build. So then you put a lot of mission assurance on it. Cost goes up, time gets delayed. And really where we need to get to is a hybrid architecture that you have some of those exquisite capabilities, because you have to have that. but you also have operational good enough capabilities that are coming off the assembly line that you can change the risk calculus and say, you know, it doesn't matter if this works perfectly because the next one's rolling off the assembly line like in the next hour or the next day or the next week. And so I think there's a business model perspective there. If you look at capabilities, because of that business model that's emerging and because smaller satellites are more operationally relevant, it is opening up a lot of different missions that are now commercially viable. In the past, the only thing that's really been commercially viable has been commercial launch and commercial communication satellites, large commercial communication satellites up in geosynchronous orbit. That's not the case today. Today, we're seeing many other mission areas become commercially viable. That's a great advantage for us. And we need to be able to leverage both the technologies that are being developed and the business model that they're using to build those technologies. I think rapid launch is going to be really important to us, and not just rapid launch, but responsive and low-cost launch. We've got a strong vision for what we call range of the future that's building on autonomy. If you look at SpaceX today, all of their rockets that are launched are done autonomously. That means the rocket, when it launches, can sense whether it's going off course and will blow itself up if it does. All the other rockets today require radars, telemetry dishes, command destruct receivers, optical telescopes, and a significant number of people to be able to operate those. Going to autonomy allows you to turn the range around really fast, allows you to increase the throughput, if you will, off of our launch pads, allows you to do so at much reduced costs. And so that's an area that we're really exploring as well. And then if you look at some of the things commercial industry is doing with adaptive manufacturing and digital engineering, we want to embrace that on the Space Force side as well, and working with our partners to do that. One of the things that we have an opportunity to do as a Space Force, because of our size and because of the industry that we have, we really believe we can develop a more fused relationship between us and commercial industry than maybe some of the other services. Look at what NASA did using commercial rocket to launch astronauts to the International Space Station for the first time since the space shuttle landed. We want to have a similar fused relationship with commercial industry.
Yes, sir. And building on that theme, it was just a few years ago when you could count the industrial base actors on one hand. And now, as you've mentioned, we have a huge surge in capability and other companies out there. When thinking about building a future Space Force, how can you best leverage these new companies to help you build that best force?
You know, one of the things that I am most proud of over the course of this first year of the Space Force is the work we've done to better understand the defense industrial base and to broaden that. The folks out at the Space and Missile Systems Center developed something called the SPEC-OT, which is bringing in a lot of non-traditional companies into our fold, if you will. We've developed partnership offices at SMC. We've done space pitch days where we're putting people on contract very quickly in one day to do innovative types of things that we think will prove valuable. We actually did the first one ever in the UK with our international partners. And so I really believe this will be an area that is ripe for growth in the Space Force, and we've already taken a pretty significant first step. I think the other thing that we're doing that is important that will help us is developing a human capital management plan that allows us to bring experts from industry into the Space Force. So maybe we reach out to Company X and say, hey, we've got a project for a couple of years. Send me a vice president. We'll bring him in as a colonel, him or her in as a colonel. We'll, you know, work for a couple of years on this project, and then we'll send them back to you. We are really looking to bring some talent in. The other thing that we're doing with our human capital strategy is looking at how do we send people to industry more regularly? How do we send people to NASA? How do we send people to our allied partners, op centers, and much more portability amongst the workforce? And I think all of those things will get after our ability to leverage this industry to a great advantage. I think it is a national advantage. I think our industry provides our nation an advantage, and we have to be able to capitalize on it. And we're building the plans and strategies to be able to do that.
Sir, this is Slick. Just again, building on that theme in the same vein, obviously competition is good, and encouraging a broad competitive space industry is good for you. But one of the things that we've heard from especially new entrants into the industry is that the acquisition system involves a strange catch-22 where the new company would already need to be on a classified contract in order to compete for a classified contract. And it kind of presents a chicken and egg conundrum. Are there any reforms that you're considering with all this work that you've done thus far and spoke of to address this challenge?
Yeah. So the very first thing I would say is we're too classified. We are overly classified, and we are working really hard to reduce the classification of some of our programs. I think that's really important. If you believe me and when I say that deterrence is our number one priority, it's really hard to change the calculus, a deterrence calculus, if you can't talk about anything that you have. And so it's a big priority for us to reduce the classification. And we have made some advances and are continuing to make advances on that front. The other thing, as you said, as it relates to our contractors, I remember a few years ago, one of my friends that had long retired out of the Air Force told me, you don't know just how much time and money industry spends trying to figure out what's in your head. And I said, you know, they don't have to spend a second or a dime figuring out what's in my head. I'll tell them. I want them to spend their time and their dollars on getting capability onto orbit. And so we had this concept of operations that we had built in partnership with our partners at the National Reconnaissance Office. And I said, okay, we're going to lay out this CONOPS for industry so they know what we're thinking. Well, when they did that, the CONOPS was so classified that I don't recall the numbers, but just a small number of people, you know, handful of people could actually come into the room and have the conversation. So we started working pilot programs to be able to change that. And I was really happy to see just here recently, the Department of Defense just put out what they call a special access program, contractor portfolio program. And that's to get at exactly what you're saying, allowing contractors to have more access into special access capabilities to be able to integrate those capabilities more effectively. And I'm excited for what I'm seeing in that program. It's important, but I will tell you up front, we're addressing it by trying to reduce the classification. And then for those things that we can't reduce, having a program that allows contractors to have more access to do what's in the best interest of our nation.
Clearly, the stand-up of Space Force and Space Command were seminal events. However, as generally is the case, after major muscle moves, there's always a lot of follow-up work that needs to be accomplished to ensure that new organizations are set up for success. You've been right in the middle of all of that. So what are some of your top goals in this regard, especially related to the fractured nature of so many different space organizations in our national security enterprise?
You know, Dave, back on 20 December of 2019, when the National Defense Authorization Act, it stated that on this day, you know, upon signature, we're up and running. And so from the 20th of December, we have been full throttle to establish the Space Force. And I couldn't be more excited for the work that has been done over the course of this first year. It's incredible, the body of work that's been accomplished. So we've built this service. Now, we're not complete with it. There's still some pieces that have to be executed, but we've got it all planned. We've got all the major muscle pieces built that we need, and we're off and running. Now, the second year, I've told my team, is all about integrating that force. We've built it. Now we got to drive it. We've got to use it. We've got to use it to advantage. One of the things that was discussed in the years leading up to the Space Force was, as you mentioned, I think it was the 65 different organizations that that have a role in space acquisitions. And I think there's 30 something different organizations that have a role in force design or architectures, you know, in of space capabilities in the domain. We really believe that the Space Force now provides that opportunity to unite the department, get everybody rowing in the same direction, reduce costs, reduce duplication of effort, and go fast to stay ahead of a growing threat. And so as I look at integration, it's integration across the department, it's integration with the joint force, it's integration with our commercial industry that we've talked about in this podcast, it's integration with our allies and partners, which is the other area that I would say we have made the most progress in this first year, is developing the relationships with our ally partners. And so the big muscle movements that we want to push across the finish line this second year is a force design that unites the department around a force design that, we can focus on, that we can resource, and that we can move at speed on. The second thing is, once you design that force, you have to be able to present that force. And so today, the way space forces are presented is through an airman. And that has to change. We are an independent service that has to be able to present its capabilities to a joint combatant command. And so that will help us integrate with the joint force more effectively with the with our geographic combatant command partners around the globe and with U.S. Space Command. And we've got a plan to do just that. And I'm excited for where that's going to lead us and the capabilities that that will provide us and our warfighting partners. The other thing is, you have to develop a readiness model for space. And today, our readiness models have largely been built around a benign domain. If you look at readiness models, it's been built around deployed capabilities rather than employed in place capabilities. So we've got General Salty Saltzman building the new readiness model for us. So again, designing the force and uniting the efforts across the department and with our allied partners and with our industry partners and with our interagency partners, being able to present that force to a combatant command in a way that makes sense and provides national advantage, and then measuring that the readiness of that force in a way that's designed for the capabilities that we provide. Those are all three big muscle movements, and we've built this force, now we have to use it.
Well, sir, following up on that, what are the things folks are not thinking about but should be when it comes to the National Security Space Enterprise? You know, if you're talking to a leader on Capitol Hill or one of your fellow service chiefs, what would you want them to be anticipating now? And are there things that are keeping you up at night because we're not working on them today?
Yeah, you know, so you don't know what you don't know, right? So, but I think, you know, the things that we've been talking about are the right things. And we've taken action on those things. And I, again, couldn't be more proud. If you look at our readiness to operate in a contested environment, and if you look at what's happened over this first year of the Space Force, first of all, we've completely overhauled how we professionally develop our guardians in the Space Force, from accessions through retirement. Every course in between has been updated to be able to reflect the strategic environment that we face. Brand new undergraduate space training that's taught at a classified level, so you can get after the threat information and give them a warfighting mindset from day one. Follow-on schools like we have in other domains to build expertise in the mission areas that they're going to. We have developed a human capital strategy to go after the best talent. You know, I was reflecting just a couple years ago, out of the Air Force Academy, we got 30 cadets that came to space. This year's graduating class will have 116. And we've interviewed every single one of them, and they're top talent cadets. I mean, they're really high talent, high caliber folks. We are getting so much interest in coming into the Space Force. We're having to turn people away, and we can be very, very selective. And that's not just on the Air Force Academy side. That's on ROTC, OTS, and also on our enlisted accessions as well. I'll tell you, I mentioned up on the last question, we have done a lot on international partnerships. What used to be one-way partnerships now have been converted into two-way partnerships, that where we train together, we operate together, we war game together. And now, for the first time, we're actually building capabilities together. And so that's, I couldn't be more impressed with that. And the advances that's going to help in our readiness and our ability to deter is really important. We've enhanced our partnerships with civil space. We signed a MOU with NASA to be able to cooperate even more fully than what we've been doing, and look at other areas where we can partnership. We integrated with the intel community. We just a few weeks ago, we became the 18th member of the intelligence community, which will allow us to be a demanding customer on the intelligence community to get after what we need to have and what General Dickinson needs to have as the U.S. Space Command commander to do his mission. We talked about broadening the defense industrial base, which I think is a huge readiness issue for the Space Force as well. We have completely reorganized national security space, and did it purpose-built for space to allow us to move at speed, collapsing two layers of command freeing up our folks to focus on the mission. What is lost on some people on that is we actually combined. So for example, in missile warning, we had a wing at Buckley that did space-based missile warning, and we had a wing at Peterson that did ground-based missile warning. Now we have one organization called a Delta that does both space-based and ground-based to fuse those together. We've done that across the mission areas. We're already seeing a significant return in investment on that. We published the first warfighting space warfighting doctrine. And that has gotten really good reviews and is going to be hugely helpful. Where we're headed next is continuing to reduce bureaucracy, continuing to reduce duplication, continuing to reduce costs, and to integrate more effectively. So I couldn't be more excited for where the advances we made for the first year. And I think we are well positioned for this second year to get some really big initiatives across the finish line, which will provide our warfighting partners and other service chiefs the space capabilities that they need and that they will always be there.
Well, Chief Raymond, it's been absolutely super to have you on our program today. You know, what you and the Space Force undertake each day is of enormous importance. And one of the reasons we've done this podcast is to get people to understand just exactly all the things and how important they all are. Too many people take these functions for granted because your team makes it all look very, very easy. And that's a major reason why we wanted to explore this topic, because we know that it's far from simple and the nation as a whole needs to better understand the challenges you and your team face. So thanks very much for taking the time, and all the best to you and our Space Force. Here's hoping that you can accomplish all your objectives rapidly and successfully.
Well, thank you again, John Deptula. I really appreciate it. And thanks for the opportunity. And thanks for all that the Mitchell Institute does for us. And I also want to thank Slick for the insightful questions. It's great to be here with you today. It's an exciting time. And if you reflect back as I started, back on Desert Storm, where this really all began with this integration of space into theater operations. And if you look at the advantages it provides, not just our military, but the average American each and every day, this is a no-fail mission. And I am really, really proud of the team of Guardians that come to work every day. They have made great progress. They do make it look easy, but we all know it's not. And so thanks very much.
Ladies and gentlemen, with that, I think we put a lot on the table that's important to consider. One thing is for certain, national security and space are inseparable. We can't conduct successful military operations without space-based technologies. That's going to take more authorities for the Space Force, more money, and more bureaucratic streamlining. This is a journey that is far from over. So plan on us revisiting the topic of national security space operations a lot on the Aerospace Advantage podcast. I'd like to offer a big thanks to our Dean, Lieutenant General Deptula, for his perspective, and a special thank you to General Raymond for his time, and of course to you, our listeners, for tuning into the podcast. Join us next time on the Aerospace Advantage as we explore the future of unmanned combat aircraft. As always, you can join in on the conversation by following the Mitchell Institute on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, or LinkedIn, or by visiting us at MitchellAerospacePower.org. Until next time, fly safe and check six.